Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. Since summer of 2014, the Black Lives Matter organization has become known for its powerful and creative efforts to draw attention to how police brutality targets African Americans. But individual activists are paying a heavy personal price with multiple criminal charges for their activism in cities around the country. That seems more true in Los Angeles than any other city. In early March, the first of six trials this year culminated in convictions for two BLM activists, Evan Bunch and Luz Flores. The two await a sentencing hearing in April. Now a second trial has begun with seven members of BLM LA facing misdemeanor charges for their involvement in the barricading of the 101 freeway in Los Angeles in November 2014. One of those seven is Rosa Clemente, community organizer, freelance journalist, and of course, you might know her name because she was the 2008 Green Party vice presidential candidate. She's currently a doctoral candidate in the W.E.B. Du Bois Department of Afro-American Studies at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and she's currently on a nationwide tour called If I Were President. Welcome to Uprising, Rosa.
Thank you for having me, Sonali.
Now, let's definitely get to what is happening in the presidential race in a little bit. But first, let's focus on this trial in Los Angeles that you're here for. It's a two-week trial. Can you tell us or describe for us the incident that these charges stem from? I mean, this happened more than a year ago.
Right. These charges stem from our actions in November of 2014, after the non-indictment of Darren Wilson for the murder of Michael Brown. And we were in solidarity with people all across the nation who that week and subsequent weeks after were in the streets and demanding justice, not only for Mike Brown, but for all victims of state violence.
And so at that time, you were a visiting scholar at Cal State LA. You were living in Los Angeles.
Yes.
And so you and I believe it was six others who are being charged were involved in blocking the freeway?
Yes, there's we call ourselves the BLM 7. And we are, yeah, seven of us who were arrested that day and have been charged. And these charges, you know, this is almost a year and a half that we've been in negotiations with the city of Los Angeles and the district attorney. And we chose not to take the plea deal that was offered because we found it completely restrictive in ways of plea deals that we had never heard of. And we feel we did nothing wrong, obviously. And we exercised our right to a jury trial.
So you were being offered a deal that would have curtailed your activism?
Yes, yes, actually, yes. The deal we were offered first still had jail time for anywhere for about 30 to 40 days. Community labor, as they call it out here. And one of the conditions, as well as 2 to 3 years probation, and as well as 2 years where we would not be allowed to attend what the state considers any unlawful protests, rallies, or marches. And if we do, we would have been in violation of our probation. And we said that's completely unacceptable. The fact that, you know, a city that prides itself on organizing and activism and how communities come together and how we, a city that prides itself around, especially this Mayor Garcetti, around social justice and equity and all of that, to offer us and tell us that for the next 2 years we would not be allowed to attend anything that is, quote, unlawful, when we know that in any given moment, any protest, march, or rally can be deemed unlawful, we were not going to take that.
Now, didn't what you engaged in November of 2014, didn't that meet the criteria of what we know as classic civil disobedience, which is essentially is supposed to be treated as a special case in the criminal justice system? You know, most people engaged in civil disobedience as an expression of political activism get a slap on the wrist, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the other part. We're part of a tradition of social justice fighters in this country who have used civil disobedience as a tool of expression. And it really also speaks to our right of assembly and our First Amendment freedom of speech. And in fact, the DA yesterday put in a motion to have First Amendment not argued in our case or brought up at any level. Luckily, the judge saw that motion as a complete trampling of our constitutional rights and said no to that. But it just shows you the level of political persecution for a case that is two misdemeanors. I mean, these are two misdemeanors, and we're going to a full trial. And you know, I really want people to also think about the amount of money that's going to be spent on this trial from the state, from people's tax dollars, and then the financial burden that it puts on organizers and activists like us who do so much work, and so many of us, you know, are working people as well, you know. So this is really trying to send a message to the broader Black Lives Matter movement in this country, and really anyone, whether you're in Black Lives Matter, the political ideology that you stand with, or you support it, or you're doing other kind of work. This is really trying to send a message that anytime we go out there and protest and act in what is an American tradition of civil disobedience, that the state is going to use every and anything that they can do to stop that.
Now, I understand two other activists in Los Angeles, Luz Flores and Evan Bunch, were also charged with multiple misdemeanor counts on charges stemming from an incident in June. There are, and I believe they were convicted, and there are a total of six criminal cases in Los Angeles alone involving Black Lives Matter. The city seems intent on charging activists scrutinizing police violence, but not as enthusiastic about prosecuting cops who kill unarmed people.
Not at all. And, you know, Evan and Luz were convicted, and they'll be sentenced in April. You mentioned other folks from BLM LA, or the broader BLM LA that extends to Pasadena as well, who are also facing charges. In fact, one of our members today is in court. Jasmine Richards will be in court this morning.
We actually did a wonderful profile of Jasmine. I know her. Yes. She's in my community. And we had a video profile of her on our website that people can search. I'm so glad you brought her up as well.
Yeah, and it's important because her charges, one of them is a felony, and it's a conspiracy charge. So there's something particularly, you know, just ugly with what LA is doing in light of the fact that the DA and the powers that be in LA, in light of the fact that this is also turning out to be one of the most murderous years in terms of police killings and shootings, and that Chief Beck happens to probably be the worst, and I call him racist, police chief that this city has ever seen, or really any city in the United States, if we look at currently what's happening in LA. So, I mean, this is definitely meant, again, to stop us. It's meant to send a chilling effect to others that stand with what Black Lives Matter, you know, is first and foremost about, the humanity of all Black people.
So we know that Los Angeles is one of the most egregious cities when it comes to police killings, but is it also more aggressively going after Black Lives Matter activists through the criminal justice system than any other city? If you compare, because BLM is very active around the country, chapters are autonomous, they're doing actions all the time, but do you see this level of prosecution and these level of criminal charges filed against other BLM activists in other cities as much as you do in LA?
All other BLM chapter organizers and activists throughout the country, their charges have either been dropped or the plea was acceptable enough that it would not curtail any of those organizers or activists. It is only in Los Angeles where all of us are being either put on trial, or no, not either. We're all being put on trial. It is only the BLM LA chapter.
That's incredible. I mean,
out of 35 chapters, mostly 35, Black Lives Matter Network now has 35, probably will go to 40 very soon. I just helped founded the Black Lives Matter chapter in upstate New York, as that is where I'm currently back. Obviously, I'm still part of BLM LA because I'm in this trial, but for 40 chapters in the United States and others that still have had to deal with the criminal justice system, because once you're arrested, you're in the system, and it still takes time out of and sacrifices that people make, even just by being in negotiations with the plea. But it's very important to people that are clear that BLM LA and the district attorneys out here and the mayor's office are the ones that are putting us on trial.
Now, Rosa, the very system that Black Lives Matter is critiquing is attempting to trap them, is attempting to bog down your activism. Can this trial be a teaching moment? Is Black Lives Matter LA using, I'm sure they're using all their resources available to show how the system that they are critiquing is exactly, you know, is exactly working against them?
Yes, I think it is. I think there's a confluence of one important thing. The recent documentary by Stanley Nelson and the Black Panther Party, and even to some extent, the pop culture moment of what Beyonce did at the Super Bowl. What that has done is that raised the level of awareness and kind of historical memory recapturing of what the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense was, and obviously the state and the attack against the Black Panther Party, the annihilation and the imprisonment of members of the BPP for Self-Defense. And I don't compare, obviously, what happened to the Black Panther Party. We're talking about murders and executions and people still in prison. But the political, persecution, it's meant to stop all of this. It's meant to also stop our young people from understanding that in 2016, this is still happening, that those of us that stand up for justice, for freedom, we exercise our rights, can be imprisoned, can be put on trial. So I think it's a very good moment, actually, to then say to the state, we're going to go to the mat for this. And even though we don't believe in this criminal justice system, right, if this is how you want to play it, we are also very well prepared, and we are willing to take, you know, the hits on this, because we're in a time where not only have we been dealing with the crisis of state violence and police brutality, we have a potential presidential candidate that is xenophobic, racist, and misogynist, and we're at a time where white nationalism is growing. And white nationalism is always supported by the state and the courts. So in a way, what we're doing is just part of an incredible Black radical tradition, and we're proud to stand with that.
I'm glad you brought up this issue of how white nationalists are always supported by the state, because recently there was a KKK rally in Anaheim, and several people were taken into custody, those who were stabbed by members of the KKK, as well as the actual stabbers themselves. All KKK members, it was reported, were released because the police believed their claim that all the stabbings were in self-defense. So these white nationalists with a history of hatred, murder, racism, were let go. Even though they were the ones who actually stabbed, I believe all were people of color who were stabbed, because the police took their side. I mean, that's just mind-blowing. That if it was people of color who were the stabbers, even if there was video evidence that they might have been doing it in self-defense, it's hard to imagine that the police would let them go.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I just think it's very clear where we're at in this moment. Even when two years ago with the rebellion in Ferguson, the subsequent rebellion in Baltimore, awakening a consciousness. This is then also how the state pushes back, right? This is how the state reacts to our acts of justice. They react with their acts of injustice. And we have to always, as organizers and activists, understand that that is actually American tradition as well. And this is why we need movements and organizing and media that is progressive and tells these stories because they're happening every day. Either someone's on trial, someone's in negotiations with plea, or someone is getting ready to commit an act of civil disobedience and will most likely be arrested for it.
Rosa Jasmine Richards, the Pasadena Black Lives Matter chapter head who is on trial, just posted to her Facebook page that she was offered 180 days in county jail, 3 years probation, 1 year of anger management, and an order to stay away from the local park where she organizes other Black residents. Unbelievable.
Yeah. It's, I mean, and you know, like, someone like Jasmine is a quintessential organizer and someone that's been birthed into the movement. A young person seeing so many of her friends murdered or you know, by street violence, by police violence, decides she wants to do something a little bit different than maybe some of the other people around her, joins the movement, is a soldier for the movement, a young working class queer person, and this is what the state does to her.
Wow. So you mentioned earlier the toll that this takes on activists, because while you're also, of course, trying to organize other actions and hold people's feet to the fire, you're also having to fight these charges against yourselves. It's a huge financial burden. It's a huge source of mental and physical stress, isn't it?
I mean, yeah, it definitely is. You know, I think sometimes, you know, it's, you ask that question, I'm even hesitant to say, oh, yeah, it is, you know, but it is, you know, and I think it's, I mean, personally for me, I'm now going to be away from my daughter for 3 weeks, you know, and even though she understands why, I'm going to be away from her. And she also is afraid, and she has a little anxiety, my husband, other people in my family. So all of us then have other people that care and love about us ultimately and don't want to see us convicted or have to go through this. And obviously there's always a financial burden. We live in a capitalist society. So I think that's why it's important that people understand this outside of just always talking about politics without the kind of revolutionary love and compassion and empathy that is sometimes we need to afford to other people. And the mental, you know, strain, obviously it's mental strain. I mean, we rather all be doing other things. We have to sit in the courtroom. We have our case alone. There's 19 cops that are the witnesses for the DA. So we're going to have to sit through 2 to 3 days of literally cops saying whatever they're going to say about us, the DA, whatever she's going to say about us and how she's going to try to paint us and all of that. So, yeah, it is all of what you said. But I also believe that because we're part of a larger network and a movement, that the support and the love and the energy that we have is part of what obviously is going to sustain us. But ultimately, that we believe that we are fighting for justice and we're part of a struggle for that, and we are ready and happy to be part of that struggle.
Rosa, you've been, in addition to the work you do with Black Lives Matter, you've been touring the country and talking about all of these issues in the framework of this historic presidential race this year. Your tour is called If I Were President. And of course, people around the country can invite you to speak to their college campuses. How has that tour been going? What are some of the conversations that you've been having centering around? I imagine people are very terrified of Donald Trump. They might be, however, in favor of Hillary Clinton, and somebody who was one of the architects or at least supporters of the current criminal justice system. Others are skeptical of Bernie Sanders because he has come, in many people's opinion, late to the game in terms of trying to build bridges with people of color. But when there is the specter of Trump, people are scrambling for other options. There aren't that many good options in the two major parties.
Yeah, I mean, first, the tour has been amazing. I mean, it will be... It is the best speaking tour I've been on in the last 15 years of doing all types of tours, you know, and the amount of young people that I've been able to speak to on the colleges. But I also, when I'm done on a campus, I go to a community center and organization. I meet with other BLM folks. I've been meeting with a lot of undocumented and unafraid organizers as well in the community. So as it regards the to the election, to be honest, outside of a lot of young people asking me if I'm going to vote for Bernie Sanders, there's like no love, obviously, for a Donald Trump. And definitely not a lot of love and enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton. And if it even comes, it's mostly young folks after saying, well, the lesser of two evils. And then I'll say, well, we don't have to have that. We have third parties. The Green Party exists. The Party for Socialism and Liberation exists. If you're in Maryland now, the Dream of People's Party exists. And obviously, for the most part, unless I bring it up, they don't know about this. And unless their families or them themselves have been in the Green Party, and they'll say, oh, I couldn't vote for you, or my mom or dad did. So I think there's definitely a lack of enthusiasm and a really marginalization that this particular demographic of young people are feeling. I would then extend that to the demographic of young people that are not on college campuses, you know, those that have been pushed out of school, the 17 to 25 year old that still can't find a job or is working three jobs just to pay the rent. And their disillusionment is very clear. They're not voting at all. You know, I guess it gives rise then to a Republican base that was always there, even though the establishment wants to act like all of a sudden they were moderate. They created Donald Trump. They're just mad that he can do what he wants to do and kind of shun the establishment. And I really feel that there's almost a psychic break that is happening with a really younger generation of people across a lot of demographic lines that I have not seen in the many years I've been involved in electoral politics.
Rosa, if there are those among our listeners who would like to invite you to their campuses, and not just because they want to hear your voice and the incredible analysis you offer, but also as a way to support the work that you're doing, what can they do?
Yeah, they can go to my website, which is www.rosaclemente.net. Not .com, but rosaclemente.net. They can reach me at my Gmail address, which is clementerosa@gmail. And all my social media handles, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, are at Rosa Clemente. I'm very active on social media. I respond to anyone who wants to bring me out. And I feel that I am, you know, super lucky to be able to go all over the country and not only speak truth to power, but myself, it keeps me evolving as an organizer and activist. And then I myself can support particularly what local communities are doing. And I'm really happy to be part of that.
And we'll post all of those details on our website, uprisingwithsonali.com, later today. Rosa, best of luck to you. Thank you so much for everything you do and for joining us.
Well, thank you, Sonali. Thank you for always uplifting our stories, especially women of color and third world people. So we appreciate you.
My guest is Rosa Clemente, a community organizer and freelance journalist. She was the 2008 Green Party vice presidential candidate. She's currently a doctoral candidate in the W.E.B. Du Bois Department of Afro-American Studies at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. And she's currently in Los Angeles to stand trial along with six other activists with Black Lives Matter on misdemeanor charges related to the shutting down of the 101 freeway in November 2014.